Welcome to Bosai. First of all, I want to welcome Rabbi Dr. Reichman. Rabbi Dr. Reichman is a Muslim of our yeshiva. He's also an emergency room. Last past few times I've spoken to him, 11:30 at night, he was in the emergency room, not as a patient, as a physician, and he's also one of the people in probably the forefront people in the area of medical ethics and medical halacha, in, certainly on this side of the Atlantic. And it's a zechus that you come every year to share some of your medicine and Torah and where they converge and how they converge. So, B'chad Rav, Rabbi Dr. Reichman.
Shkaya. Thanks so much for my earlier. A pleasure and supposed to be here with you gentlemen. As I earlier mentioned, my interest is in the general field of medical halacha. We're going to talk about one specific topic today. But I always give an open invitation. If you guys are interested in any aspect of medical halacha, Rabbi Orlian has my email. You're more than welcome to contact me. I'm happy to assist you in any issues that you guys are involved in, both in terms of academics, in terms of understanding these issues, and also it's going to be a halacha lemaisa for you guys pretty soon also. So if you have any questions or I can direct you in any way, please do not hesitate. The topic for our discussion, which Rabbi Orlian and I discussed for today, is the common denominator of all the topics that we're going to discuss is risk and the assessment of risk and the ability to incur risk or to embark on different behaviors that involve risk. And we are specifically going to address the following topics today. We're going to address blood donation, bone marrow donation, living kidney donation, contagion in rabbinic literature, smallpox inoculation, and modern diseases and Ebola. So I hope you guys brought your protective gear, because I brought a little Ebola with me to show you guys. We're going to start off with a couple of case studies. This is very informal. If there's anything I say that requires clarification, or if you have any questions, don't hesitate to raise your hand. Don't hesitate to ask. We're going to start off with a couple illustrative cases, three cases, and then we'll use these cases as a springboard for our discussion about the topics that we just mentioned. Case study number one, LB suffers from leukemia, and a bone marrow donation is recommended by his doctors. The Gift of Life holds a bone marrow drive at Yeshiva University. MJ reads the sign at the elevator and wonders whether he should join the bone marrow drive. Donating might be painful, might cause him to miss his exams. He doesn't even know anybody suffering from leukemia. Should he join? Furthermore, if he joins and is found to be a match, is he obligated halachically to perform the donation? That is case study number one. Case study number two. This is an actual case. And the case, I'll just summarize the case for you as follows. There was a young girl who suffered from kidney disease, and her parents, as the actual the case was, it's not so relevant for our discussion, but the husband and wife had actually separated, and the husband happened to be in prison. And he found out that his daughter was now in kidney failure and in need of a kidney transplant. So he actually volunteered to donate a kidney to his daughter, and he did so, and the kidney donation was initially successful. However, as you may or may not know, when you receive any organ donation, you need to take medications to prevent your body from rejecting that organ, called immunosuppressive medications. She, as a teenager, neglected to take those medications, and she rejected the kidney. He then made the following offer: I would like to donate my second kidney to my daughter. And if he would donate his second kidney, what would happen to him? Do you guys know?
He'd be on dialysis.
He'd be in dialysis, right. So he wouldn't die. It's not like he's donating his heart. If you donate a second kidney, even if someone has no kidneys or complete kidney failure, they can go on dialysis. So the question is it halachically mutter for him to donate his first kidney? Is it halachically mutter for him to donate his second kidney? Our third case: you are a chaplain in the local hospital, and one of your Jewish patients is diagnosed with Ebola, rachmana litzlan. What are the guidelines for your visitation? And follow-up question, you are a Rav and a doctor in your congregation. Asks, I am now working in a hospital where they are treating Ebola patients. Can I refuse to treat these patients because it's too risky? What is your psak? Let us begin now with a discussion about organ donation. And we begin as just to clarify, our discussion today will be restricted to living organ donation. There's an entire other sugya, and a major aspect of donation is cadaveric donation, which is donation after death. It's a different medical reality, and it's a different halachic reality. I believe Rabbi Shabtai will have an opportunity to speak. If not, I'm happy to address the topic if necessary. So we're going to discuss now the issue of living organ donation. First of all, which organs can be donated from one living human being to another? So here's your list. You may not realize that blood is actually an organ. Technically, it's the largest organ in the body. Bone marrow can be donated from one living human being to another. A kidney can be donated, as we'll see. Part of a liver, not the entire liver, and part of a lung can be donated safely. Well, that's part of the issue. We'll discuss how safely it is. And these are the things that can be donated. So now, for the next few minutes, we're going to discuss an overview of the major halachic sources that deal with the issue of risk and your chiyuv for risk. Now, here we're focusing, in the live donation issue, we're focusing on the donor, not the recipient. We're focusing on an individual, whether an individual is able to donate blood or bone marrow or kidney or liver or lung. We're focusing on the risk to that individual. So the question number one is, what would be my chiyuv to donate to another individual at all? What's the source of that chiyuv? So the source of that chiyuv is the pasuk lo samado dam re'echa. Don't stand, however you want to translate it, don't stand idly by as the blood of your brother is being shed. So we're going to spend a few moments just to analyze how the post can deal with this sugya. So this is the Gemara in Sanhedrin. The Gemara in Sanhedrin says, Minayin laroa es chavero, shu tovea banar. How do you know that if someone's drowning in the ocean, ochaya goros, or he's being attacked by a wild animal, o listin boinalov, or he's being attacked by robbers or thieves, that you have a chiyuv to save that individual. So Talmud Lomar, lo samar adam riecha. The pasuk seems clear, lo samar adam riecha, that is the source of the chiyuv. So the Gemara says, we have another makar, which might indicate our chiyuv to save another individual. What is that makar? Avedas gufo minayin, Talmud Lomar, v'hashiv osolo. So there is a chiyuv of hashiv osolo, hashavas aveda. What is the most valuable object that you own, aside from your laptops and iPads and iPhones, is your body. Your body is the most valuable object. So for sure, if you have the chiyuv hashavas aveda to restore a monetary object, halachas kama v'kama, you have a chiyuv hashavas aveda to restore your life. And while not our discussion today, there is a major machlokes in the Rishonim in terms of which pasuk is the makar for the chiyuv refuah, for the chiyuv, or the heter actually of refuah, for a physician to be able to cure patients. So the Rambam actually says the Hashiv Osolo, many others learned, most learned from the Rapo Yurape. But this is a key pasuk in the field of medicine and halacha. So so now we have two psukim. We have a hashiv osolo or two limudim, and lo samar adam riecha. So the Gemara says, imi hasam, if I only had the limud from hashavas aveda, havamina hani mili benafshei about mitrach omigra gure lo. So if I only had the pasuk of hashavas aveda, then I would apply the halachos of hashavas aveda. And the halachos of hashavas aveda, I have a personal chiyuv to try and restore a lost object. So if someone drops a pen, I have a chiyuv to pick it up. And today, in the Bisman Azed, to translate it into contemporary, to modern obligations, you probably have an obligation to post it on global websites or even, you know, do a blast email, you know, to see if someone lost something, because there's no financial expenditure in that case. But technically, you are not mechuyev to spend money for Hashavas Aveda. So you're not mechuyev to put an ad on a website or in a local newspaper or in the New York Times, which would run you hundreds to thousands of dollars, to restore any object. You're not mechuyev for monetary layout. So that's what the Gemara says. Kamash Malan, we have both psukim that you not only have a bodily obligation to physically restore an object, you also have a monetary thing. Now, the nature of this monetary chiyuv, we're not going to discuss extensively today. There's the two general gedarim for chiyuv, for how much you have to spend, depend on whether it's an asse or a lav. So to be mekayim an asse, you generally have to spend chomesh, the fifth of your monetary capability. And to prevent yourself from doing a lav, you generally have to spend kol mamono. So the question is this a lav or is it an asse? It involves an action in order to perform it, but it's phrased in terms of a lav. It's lo samar al damar yachos, is machlok sefoskim, whether you have to lay out to save somebody, whether you have to lay out a fifth of your finances or your entire fortune. So the Beis Yosef, in Choshen Mishpat, writes the following. It says, Avra lo samar, kasuv hagos maimonios, the safek sakana chayiv. So the Beis Yosef, this is not in his Shulchan Aruch, this is in the Beis Yosef, this is a key distinction. He says that you are obligated in a case of Safek Sakana to save somebody's life. Now what is the Mukar? What is this Yerushalmi? He doesn't tell us where this Yerushalmi is. Many people have scoured the Yerushalmi looking for possible makoros. This is the classic one that people point to. This case in Yerushalmi is Be'isi Itzid B'Safsufe. Be'isi was captured in the city of Safsufa. And Rav Yonason said, Yikaref Meis B'Sedino. They were devising a plan to save him. And these were pretty violent people. I mean, put it into contemporary context. You know, he's captured by ISIS. And you know these guys are radical, and they will kill anybody and everybody, and they have no qualms about it. So are you going to perform a rescue in this situation, or are you just going to throw up your hands and say, there's nothing I can do? So here, Rabbi Yonason says, Yikaref Hameis B'Sedino, it's an expression meaning there's really nothing we can do. We basically have to theoretically prepare for burial, put him in his, think about shrouds for him, because it's a fait accompli. Rav Shimon ben Lakish, Rish Lakish had an interesting history himself as someone who was quite a remarkable person and may actually play a role in why he wanted to do what he wanted to do. But he said, "Ad on a katil onamis katil." So I'd rather die than let him die. So I am going to go and attempt to save him. And the Gemara records that indeed he was able to successfully appease them, and he was able to save them. So some say that this is the makar for the Hagos Maimonios, which the Beis Yosef quotes, that it is indeed perhaps obligatory to put yourself in a fair amount of risk in order to save somebody's life. But when he wrote the Shulchan Aruch, Rabbi Yosef Karo did not include that statement. He just included the Gemara, and it was also restated by the Rambam, which is Haroa es chavera tovea bayam, at least in Boim Olav. You see somebody who's in some form of danger, v'yachol lehatzilo, and you can save him, ohu be'atzmo, either you yourself can physically intervene and save him, oh shiyiskor acherim lehatzil, or you can hire somebody else to save it. So it's a twofold obligation. There's a bodily obligation and a financial obligation. V'lo yitzil overal lo samar adam reyachol. And again, he neglects to make that statement if it's a significant sakana that you're mechuyev to do it. So what we do not know from the Shulchan Aruch, and we only really know, and this is probably the first makor, the first classic makor to deal with this, is indeed you have a chiyuv to save an individual. You have a chiyuv, a financial chiyuv, a bodily chiyuv. But exactly how much risk do you have to incur in order to save somebody else? And that's really the nugget which we need to extract to apply to contemporary circumstances of blood donation, of bone marrow donation, of kidney donation, and of risk in contagious diseases. So this is a lengthy redbaz, and this is just a small excerpt. The case you may have heard of, Sha'alti mimani, odiacha da'ati al mashiro isa, kosuv, im amar hashulton li Yisrael, hanach li tos eiver echad, shein chameis mimenu, It's a tragic scenario, one which unfortunately we have seen time and time again in Jewish history. If a soldier, a dictator, a despot is standing in front of two Jews and he says to one Jew, allow me to amputate one of your limbs, and if you don't, I will kill the Jew standing next to you. Are you obligated to do such a thing? Right? Now what's the svara? What's the svara? What's the svara to obligate? Any thoughts? Why would you be mechuyev to do it? For lo sama, good, excellent. Why would it be usher to do? Hayecha kodmim, exactly, or nishmartem lo nafsho seichem. So you not only have an obligation to save someone else, you have an obligation of self-preservation. Hayecha kodmim, right. So what does the Radbaz say? The Radbaz briefly sets three categories for us. We'll apply those three categories to the different types of case studies that we discussed today. So category number one is when the risk, and this is a simplification, there's tremendous amount of folks opposing exactly how to interpret the Radbaz, and the statistical probabilities as well, but for our case, we will simplify. Assuming it's greater than 50% chance that you will die in the course of this rescue. So the Rabbaz in that scenario says it is usur for you to engage in that rescue based on Chayat HaKodmim or based on Yishmash Rodman HaShasechem. And famously, he is quoted as saying, one who engages or embarks on such a rescue is considered a chasid shota. That's his classic phrase. Chasid shota, translated in English, is a pious fool, is the classic translation. On the other polar extreme, if the risk is very small, even though there is a risk, you are mechuyev to do it, because that's the chiyuv lo samano dam riecha. Chiyuv is not to do it only when there's no risk. Chiyuv is to do it when there's a limited risk. Question is, what about those two polar extremes? When it's not a limited risk and it's not a severe risk, then what do you do? So there the Radbaz says, you are neither mechuyev, nor is it usur. And it is volitional at that stage. So in that intermediate category, which Lamaisa covers a lot of cases, it is absolutely mutter for you to do it, but you're not mechuyev to do it. And the Radbaz adds that it is a tremendous chus for someone who has the wherewithal to make that decision and indeed to proceed and rescue, even though there is a significant risk involved. So let us apply these to the fields of blood donation. We'll expand our discussion a little more beyond just the issue of risk and cover some general halachic issues related to blood donation and living donation in general. Let us begin with the history of blood donation. This is the very first blood donation ever, it's just interesting. There are different accounts about the first blood donation, but I share this with you because of the relationship to Jewish physicians in history. So this is an article in the Annals of Medical History, appeared in 1917, and reading from the top, says we may safely start in the month of June 1490 in Rome, when blood is said to have been transfused by a Jewish physician named Abraham Mayer of Balmus into the veins of Pope Innocent VIII. The blood was taken, according to the story, from the veins of three boys of 10 years of age, and they were each paid, which, by the way, is relevant in terms of paying for donation today. It was introduced into the veins of the pontiff, and I love this next line, and he either died or recovered. Go figure. So they say that it was a Jewish physician who performed the first blood transfusion, and parenthetically, he performed it on none other than the Pope. So just an interesting historical tangent. We happen to know this person from other sources. Avram de Balmus was a Jew living in the 1400s-1500s. And not our discussion today, but perhaps discussion for another time, especially those of you who are interested in pursuing medicine. There's a very rich history about the practice of Jewish physicians and the training of Jewish physicians in times previous to our own. So today, when one wants to apply to medical school as a Jewish medical student, you simply fill out an application like anybody else, and you get an interview like anybody else. In pre-modern times, especially in the Middle Ages and early Renaissance, all the universities were run by the Catholic Church. It was actually, by decree, prohibited for Jews to attend universities. And if you were, the only way you could attend a university, is if you, especially a medical school in those days, is if you literally received permission from the Pope himself. So imagine you guys, you know, a young frum guy, you know, comes out of a yeshiva, wants to go to medical school. The only way you could get into medical school is to literally get permission from the Pope himself. Right, exactly. So here is perspective. So this actually is a copy of his very diploma, his medical diploma, Abraham de Balmas, 15th century Italy. Needed, and not only did you need special permission from the Pope to graduate, you need special permission from the Pope to be able to treat Christians. And Christians, because there was a fear, this is a reciprocal fear, by the way, that Jews would kill the Christians and the Christians would kill the Jews in the course of medical care. So there was reciprocal suspicion. So you needed special heter from the Pope in order to be able to do that. And he actually wrote a sefer on Dictuk, this fellow, Mikna Avraham, which is published posthumously. Those of you who are familiar with the history of publishing in Hebrew books, he was a colleague and friend of Daniel Bamberg. Daniel Bamberg was a Christian who was the first person to publish the complete Shas. And he's a rich history. So blood donation today, how risky is blood donation? So that's really our question in terms of risk. So the question is, how risky do you think it is? So all of you are going to say, it's not that risky. People don't die. But any question which is asked from a medical perspective, and we're going to discuss the halachic ramifications of it, you need to have medical backup for that statement. So you can't just anecdotally say it's not risky. You have to analyze medically whether it is or it isn't. And here's a study. You don't get too many studies with the N, which is number of patients, like this. 2,575,264 donations. And they recorded all the complications of those donations. And there were very few complications. So nobody's dying from blood donation. People can faint. Sometimes they get infected from the needle. You know, if you don't have your Stella Dora cookies, you know, when I was growing up, they always served Stella Dora cookies when they gave blood donations. Now I'm sure they're serving probably catered gourmet stuff, or at least Entenmann's, you know, if they match up from the...
Did they say zero deaths or just very, very few?
I'm sorry?
Did they say there are zero deaths or just
I don't think there are any recorded deaths.
Okay.
Yeah. Rates of complication, long-term morbidity. I don't think there are any recorded deaths. A total of 752 out of 2.5 million, moderate and severe complications. Just to share with you the value halachically and the importance of donation and how Gedolim respect blood donation, I share with you the following story. This is a story which appears in a wonderful book called the B'Domayich Chayi, which is an entire sefer just on blood donation. And this story is of a person. They just give you his Rashi Tevis over there, his initials. And he was undergoing a surgery, so he went to every gadol he could find to get a bracha for the surgery. So he went to Shlomo Zalman. Of course he went to Shlomo Zalman, who was alive at that time, to ask him for a bracha. But after he finished making the rounds, he said, "Did I miss anybody? Is there anybody else I can go to get a bracha?" So Shlomo Zalman says, "I want you to go to this man to get a bracha." So the person, you know, sort of shrugged his shoulders. He said, you know, obviously without meaning chas shalom, any disrespect. He says to Shlomo Zalman, you know, to what attribute do I owe the godless of this person that I should go to him for a bracha? So Shlomo Zalman said that this person, that this Rav, makpid litrom dam lebayit hadam b'chol shlosha chodoshim. Every 3 months, he donates blood to the blood bank. Kachu ose lo shana lo shanotayim. He hasn't done it for 1 year or 2 years. For 30 years, every 3 months, he goes to the blood bank and he donates his blood. Adam kazeh shmucham latet gufo lezulat. Someone like that who's willing to give up his own body to help save someone else, zehu tzadik amiti, mimenu kedai lekabel bracha. From someone like that, it's kedai to get a bracha. Yes?
Can you Can I ask a very simple question? Is it a plot? Is it different whether one's donating to Jews or non-Jews?
It very well may be. Very well, good, but we'll see. We'll see that distinction here in the United States. There aren't important nafkaminas. In general, and to back it up, really the question is, who does Lo Samro Dam Re'echa apply to? So technically, Lo Samro Dam Re'echa applies to Re'echa B'mitzvos. It doesn't technically apply to Goyim. So, you know, how you incorporate, you know, in a secular society, you know, whether it's Lifnei Mishur HaSadin, whether it's not Lifnei Mishur HaSadin, whether donating to the non-Jewish world is beneficial in some way to the Jewish community also, that's a complicated... I'm sorry?
Isn't it also a sort of possible Kabbalah?
Right, so all these things, excellent. So there are Isurim involved in Kabbalah, although blood donation is relatively minor, but kidney donation... So how are you going to justify Chavol? You need to have a justification for the Chavol.
You
want to
call it between major and minor Chavol?
So, I mean, especially in just a needle stick. I mean, there definitely is a distinction, a medical distinction. Halachically, there's an Isser Chavol for a small cut also. There's other concerns of Netilas Neshama, which is another aspect maybe we'll get to. But the so in terms of the heter to donate, clearly, beyond a shadow of a doubt, It falls into the lowest category of the Radbaz. There's no way it's usher to donate, and indeed, maybe mechuyev to donate. But the question is, how are you going to be mechuyev to donate? What's the scenario? So let's just talk a little bit about donation from an individual, and we'll talk about donation to a blood bank, which addresses your issue of the non-Jewish population also. Halacha I efshar lichfos adam. The Davar Sheyeshwa Kamadeos, I'll just quote some of these people. Going with Moshe Halberstam, said she'ef shal likfosel trumas adam. You cannot coerce someone to donate blood. Why can't you coerce somebody to do it? Because technically, and this is a big distinction between blood donation and bone marrow donation. For blood, there are many people who could have the same blood type. You know, there's basically four major blood types: A, B, AB, and O. And there are millions or tens of millions of people with the exact same blood type. So what is to be mechayev you as one individual to have to donate that blood? Really, you could say, he has a fear just like I have a fear. Why are you going to force me? So just keep that in mind, because that may be different in a case of bone marrow donation. And Rav Vosner in Bnei Brak, writing about the chiyuv of hatzala, when it might cause you some inconvenience or weakness, benidam shilafaneinu afal pi she'achshav lo nagim rova olam bazeh b'chai gav nevada mechuyav litein. Said you are mechuyav to give. Now, does that mean someone can come to you and force you to give? Probably not. But he holds you are mechuyav to give. Rav Chaim Pinchas Scheinberg says, "L'kach nira din yesh matzav." Now, here's the nafkamina. Yesh matzav shel pikuach nefesh. Utzrichim l'sug dam nadir. Let's say here's the scenario. Let's say you're in a small town, right? And there's someone who's undergoing a surgery, and he has AB negative blood, which is the rarest form of blood. And the surgeons nick the aorta on the table, and blood starts spurting up to the ceiling, and the patient's starting to exsanguinate. And if you don't get a blood transfusion, the patient's going to die. And they come and knock on this guy's door. There's one other person in the town, and he's got AB negative blood. Is he mechuyev to donate? Can you coerce him to donate? Can you tie him up, bring him to the hospital, and extract the blood from him? Now, from an American medical perspective and legal perspective, do you think you could do something like that? Yeah, not a chance in the world. From a halachic perspective, indeed, it may be possible. You may actually be able to. Now, even today, the state of Israel can't do it. The state of Israel is not a theocratic state. But in a halachic world, halachic universe, indeed, you may be mechuyev to do it. And why? Because it's an application of Lo Samro Dam Re'echa. Because not only does he have an obligation of Lo Samro Dam Re'echa as an individual, we as a society have an obligation to ensure that he fulfills his obligation of Lo Samro Dam Re'echa, even if it means coercing him to serve as a blood donor. Not our topic for discussion today, but the whole notion of coercion in medical treatment is a major topic. So I encounter not infrequently in the practice of emergency medicine patients who refuse treatment. And I know fully well that this treatment could be completely curative, and without the treatment, they will die. Are they allowed to refuse such treatment or not? So one of the famous halachic sources on this comes from the more obscure of Yaakov Emden, writing in the 1700s, and he actually was writing about an amputation, and he, in essence, said, because, and this is a key factor for broader discussions about medical treatments, that while in the United States and really across the Western world, they operate on the principle of autonomy, which means that the patient has a right to decide whatever they want, even if it's to their own detriment, as long as they're of sound mind. In halacha, that's simply not the case. A person doesn't have bilis on his goof, and a person cannot discard the goof and has a chiyuv to preserve it, even against their own wishes. So he said, if a patient refuses an amputation, it's not their right to refuse the amputation, and you can do it against the patient's will. Interestingly, this Moriv Ktsiyah was quoted in a contemporary decision just a few years back about a girl who needed a hand amputation because of a cancer that she had. And she was refusing the amputation. And the judge, he didn't base it exclusively on this, but he cited Rabbi Yaakov Emden in his court decision, who, according to halacha, specifically allows you to coerce the patient against their will if you know that the outcome is going to be a successful outcome. Now, which means that the risk-benefit is very clear. Then you're clearly allowed to coerce. If it's a scenario where, even with the amputation, the patient may not survive, and that's a complicated analysis, that wouldn't necessarily apply in that case. It has to be relatively clear-cut. Just to share with you, a unique approach to blood donation is from Tzitz Eliezer. And here he writes, "Hinei li yesh gisha acheret b'chol hanidon." Tzitz Eliezer has a very unique analysis specifically to blood donation. He bases it on the following: "Dati hi d'biyosa Torah he'ida v'kavok ki nefesh habasor badam hu." So he takes this pasuk, "Nefesh habasor badam hu," that ki nefesh kol bria badam hu tluya. Chazal kavu pized reviz dam hishir chiyu social adam lo kovei ma shegiza machliv imkain yeshel chayus adam litram yotem reviz midamo avor kiyum shum mitzvah prat avor gimel mitzvah sayiduos. So he says, because of this unique interpretation of the psukim, that ki adam lo nefesh, that there is a nefesh, the soul is somehow spiritually integrated into the dam, so that would preclude obligating anyone to donate blood. So according to Tzitz Eliezer, if this case may be negative blood, this guy's exsanguinating on the table after the surgeon nicked the aorta, he would say you are absolutely not mechuyev to do it, because you are not mechuyev to give of your nefesh in order to save somebody else. That the Torah can't be mechuyev to do. Just a side note, Tzitz Eliezer was also famous for a very radical and challenged interpretation of... you have a question?
Yeah, how much, what percentage of a person's blood is usually given in donation?
So it's usually a few pints. So it's more than Raviz.
It's more than
Raviz. Yeah, way more than Raviz. Raviz is like this. Yeah. He would allow you to give Raviz. Raviz is not helpful in any substantive fashion for medical purposes. A few pints of blood, and the blood regenerates, by the way, which is another key factor in our discussion. So, just a brief tangent here: that Tzitz Eliezer is famous for this radical approach when he was asked about paternity testing. You know about this one? In paternity testing, he said, because today we test the father to be able to determine, we base it on the genetics of the father. So he said, you cannot base anything on the genetics of the father, because the Gemara in Nida says that there's shlosha shutfin yesh ba'adam, there's three partners in the creation of man, and it says in that Gemara that the dam comes from the mother. And if the dam comes from the mother, then it doesn't come from the father. You can't use a blood test to be able to identify paternity. And this created a tremendous stir. The then chief rabbi, Rabbi Herzog wrote the following in response. He goes, I shall not, and by the way, he wasn't the only one. There was another Sephardic chief rabbi agreed with that. He said, I shall not, this is Rabbi Herzog writing, I shall not conceal from you the fact that I was practically embarrassed by your dismissal of the use of blood tests for precluding paternity, the use of them specifically to establish that A was not the father of B. How can one raise the issue of reliability of physicians in a matter that is accepted as fact by medical science throughout the world? Nowhere did the sages state that the existence of a certain animal they mentioned was halacha received from Moses or Sinai, nor could they have said so, for as we know today, there is no such animal ever existed. So he's talking about another sugya. But in any case, he says it's if the scientists say, you know, how can one compare the medicine of antiquity to the medicine of today? He says the scientists clearly, unequivocally say that you can determine paternity based on blood typing. Then you can absolutely rely on the physicians to determine the paternity with a blood test of your father. Today we're doing more sophisticated testing. It's not just blood typing. We're doing DNA testing, which is a significant notch up from blood typing. And that whole topic, that whole issue of approaching Ma'amare Chazal that talk about science and medicine and putting it into the context of modern medicine today is a vast topic, and anyone who's alive today discusses and addresses this topic, especially if you're in any field of science or medicine. It's generally subsumed under the category of Mishtana HaTeba, which is a phrase which is invoked to in essence say that the science at the times of Chazal is different from the science of today, and what exactly that means and how it's reflected in the Makaris of Chazal. I think we gave a talk, I don't know if it was with you, Uri, but we gave an entire one of the contemporary halachic sessions just on this topic of Mishtana Teva, going through all the sugyas of Shas and Rishonim and Achronim that seem to reflect medical knowledge, which is not in consonance with medical knowledge today, and how we deal with that conflict. Interestingly, Lahavdil, there is a religion which has a similar analysis of blood transfusion to the Tzitz Eliezer, and that is the J witnesses. I'm not going to say the full name J because that's a shame Hashem. But the J witnesses are a religion, if you can call it that, of people who do not receive blood transfusions, in essence for the same, it's somewhat similar. So they don't necessarily focus on the nefesh part. They focus on the iser achilas dam. Af basar ben afshod demolos socheilu hacholas achaltas adam veifaytabo mekar bima. I don't think I read that correctly, but in any case, the J witnesses say that you're not allowed to ingest blood, and that includes intravenous transfusion of blood, and that has big ramifications as a physician when you're treating a patient who's a witness and who's exsanguinating or is having some blood loss. So I remember I had a woman who has had serious gynecological bleeding. She was bleeding a tremendous amount, needed blood transfusion. She says, I'm not going to accept any blood transfusions. And these patients will die without blood transfusion, and they do. And the question is, if it's a minor, what do you do in those cases where the parents say, we will not accept a blood transfusion on behalf of our child, but the child isn't old enough to make that decision for themselves? So they're illegal. You have a question on that?
Yeah, when you have a similar problem, for instance, as I was, what if the parents refuse to allow the child in their state of the people like Sally Ezra, if you hold like some other person, can you force?
Tzitzeliezer is talking about donating. He doesn't have a problem receiving. Yeah, that's true. It's a good. He doesn't have a problem with receiving. So these guys have a problem receiving. So today there are ways to get around this. This, by the way, they have their own halacha about which blood products you're allowed to receive and which not. They even have a halacha that you're allowed to receive the blood intraoperatively if it's a procedure and you're within the same procedure. This is interesting chakira. You're within the same procedure and the blood never leaves the connection to the body and is returned to the body. That's okay according to J witnesses. So they actually have a system called a cell sorter, intraoperative cell saver, which is designed specifically with this patient population in mind. And it doesn't really fit their halachic criteria, but it's basically the same concept. They take the blood that comes out of the patient in the operating room, bring it through a machine, and restore it back into the patient, so they don't have to get outside blood transfusion. So there's a question about platelets and other forms of blood products, but we don't need to waste time on that. Now, we were talking about donating from one individual to another individual. What about donating to a blood bank? Right, everyone's lining up at the blood bank to give their deposits. So what's the nafkamina there? So here, and I quote from Rabbi Arye Leibowitz, who's a rabbi in DRS High School, and for those of you who haven't heard his 10-minute halacha, you will enjoy it immensely. It's tremendously packed and always lucid and informative. So he wrote an article on blood banking and blood donations in particular, and he said we live in a society with Jewish blood banks, without Jewish blood banks. So this was your question about Jew versus non-Jew. Without Jewish blood banks, and the only way the Jewish community can carry its fair burden of giving blood to save Jews is by donating to the general blood bank. That's the only way you can accomplish that. If 5% of the general population is Jewish, and Jews donate 5% of the blood, certainly halacha accepts that such a system is proper, because there is no mechanism to designate which blood goes where. And this is in Eretz Yisrael, admittedly, but just to show you the importance of blood donation, this is a psak by Moshe Halberstam, who was, it was a Tisha B'Av, I believe. Sipur Ma'anyen Yerapam B'Tisha B'Av, right. There was a blood shortage on Tisha B'Av. And he paskin that people who were fasting could break their fasts on Tisha B'Av and go to the blood bank and donate blood. And they said to him, other people can do it who aren't fasting. He said, my psak stands that anybody that, and he said, even if you're fasting, and if you're a gadol, or if you're not withholding fast for any other reason, you can break your fast and you can go donate blood, obviously reflecting the importance of blood donation. Just for you to be aware, there are discussions, and sometimes they hit the media, and you'll see them occasionally in the post-game, very occasionally, about specifically the Jew to non-Jew donation, the man to woman donation, that there is concern about this. So this was an article which appeared in the media. An Israeli rabbi has ruled that an Orthodox Jewish man should stay away from taking blood of a woman, should not receive blood of a non-Orthodox Jew, etc. So is this normative halacha, or is this sort of peripheral psak in the mainstream is otherwise? So here, this is Menashe Akotrim. Menashe Klein wrote similarly, Levad ki ein min haroi, and it works in all directions in terms of receiving, in terms of giving. So here he's talking about specifically giving. He goes, ein min haroi li tein mi dam Yisrael sheyesh bo nefesh, nishmas ruach Hashem, because you shouldn't give your blood. So I guess he's aligning himself to some extent with the Tzitz Eliezer's interpretation of the soul invested in the blood. You shouldn't give that lahaviro beguf tamei ba'akum. You shouldn't donate blood to a non-Jew. So that is not the mainstream approach. Here you have just one psak. This is Vayashiv Moshe. There's a few Vayashiv Moshes. This one was by Moshe Zarger. And he writes that you absolutely can give blood, even if your blood ultimately goes to a goy. It's absolutely essential. And he says, Nitztarich l'rapeh gam goyim mizeh, v'adeh shemisrapeh goyim mishum sakana, shelo yomru hadam, shedam hagoyim einam chashuvim b'enyenu. You shouldn't say that the goyim are not significant. And I mean, imagine the PR, and this touches on many other issues, of Mishum Eva. You know, if we didn't donate blood, we said we were only going to donate blood to Jews, we're not going to donate blood to non-Jews, then reciprocally, they would say, well, then you're not going to get blood from anybody else, you're only going to get blood from Jews, if that. And many Jews would end up dying, because there simply isn't enough blood to do that. So there are many ramifications of this kind of shita. Yeah.
As for the Jews, they don't take blood either.
Right, they don't take blood either. Right. Where it becomes more of an issue is in other forms of donation, where people don't donate kidneys, for example. Can they receive kidneys? And that's an issue with more cadaveric donation. The non-Jew-Jew distinction, just to share with you, for the sake of completeness, the Gemara does say explicitly, zir masusim, zir masam, if you're referring to goyim, and their ochle shkatzim or remasim. So their bodies are not as tahor as ours, who are eating only food that's kosher and being ovdei Hashem. So the Chassam Sofer made a very interesting comment based on this fact, with claiming that there are anatomical ramifications to this, that based on the ingestion of the goyim versus the ingestion of the Jews, that there may be a difference of the actual anatomy, physical bodies between the Jews and the non-Jews. And he writes, "Mipnei zeh koshali lismoch b'shem hora'a al rofei zmanenu. I can't rely on the physicians of our time. I feel Yisrael. Why? Dekol mumchasam al pi sifrei refuos shenasu al yidei nisoyam. So their knowledge of anatomy is al pi shenasu begufan shalahen. So he actually suggests that maybe you can't rely even on the Jewish physicians, because the Jewish physicians are training on non-Jewish bodies, and you may not be able to extrapolate from the anatomy of a non-Jewish body to the anatomy of a Jewish body because of the chol gufayo and of fishkots and muslim. Again, this is not a mainstream shita, but you will hear this surface from time to time. You'll understand where it's coming from. It's based on the Gemara and Shabbos. So now let's move from blood donation to bone marrow donation. And how is that the same? How is it different? So you may be familiar with the gift of life. How many people here are familiar with the gift of life? Baruch Hashem. There is a bone marrow donation drive run by the Medical Ethics Society here every year. You guys are aware of that? I mean, is everybody aware of that? Not aware of that? A very important thing. They say here, he who has saved the life of one as if he was saving the life of the entire world. And that's the Gemara in Sanhedrin. That's a famous, quoted many, many times in the context of our discussion. But here, it really rings true, more so than in other cases. This is the website. This is the YU website. 4,983 sponsored donors. There have been 292 matches just from YU alone. Just from YU alone, 44 transplants from YU alone. We're not talking about globally. We're not talking about everywhere else in the world. We're talking about just from YU. These are the most recent. October 14th. October 6th, September 15th, all 2014. These have all been matches, and we don't know the results of all of them, but they've all been successful matches. So, what is bone marrow donation? Let me just share with you what exactly bone marrow donation is. When is bone marrow donation used? So, blood donation is used for people who have anemia from a whole host of causes, people who have blood loss from a whole host of causes. So bone marrow donation can be used likewise for multiple purposes. It's usually used for people who suffer from certain cancers that affect the blood system. So their blood system is not functioning properly. You basically remove the person's blood system and replace it with an entirely new blood system. That's what a bone marrow transplant is. Now today that can be accomplished in a number of ways. It used to be that it was accomplished by literally taking a needle and inserting a drill with this needle into the bone marrow, often of the hip, which is the largest area and acquired the most bone marrow, but in multiple spots. And you would take a syringe, and this is still done today, and you would extract the bone marrow from the individual, and that bone marrow can then be transplanted into somebody who needs a bone marrow transplant. Today, there is another option, which touches on another issue of medical halacha, which we're only going to briefly mention now, and that is you can do what's called a stem cell harvest. Now, what's a stem cell harvest? Now, stem cells, when you think about stem cells, you usually think about stem cells that are harvested from human embryos. Those are called embryonic stem cells. But a stem cell is really an immature cell which has the capability to produce mature cells. And in our bodies, there are stem cells within different organ systems. So there are stem cells in our hearts, there are stem cells in our brains, there are stem cells in our bone marrow. The bone marrow stem cell can generate a bone marrow, literally. So today, as opposed to, so you don't necessarily have to bore a needle into the bone itself. You can give certain medication, which will make the stem cells available, and then you can just simply do like you do a blood donation. You put a needle in, and the blood flows through a machine, which will extract the stem cells. And they can use those stem cells, literally a handful of stem cells, to regenerate an entire bone marrow in someone who needs a bone marrow transplant. Now, there are many indications for bone marrow transplant. Some of them are curative, and it will completely eradicate the disease, and the person will be completely healthy. Some of them are palliative, where a person will not be cured of their disease, but they will survive longer, either for a few months or a few years longer, with the bone marrow donation. And some of them are experimental, so which we don't know if they will work at all or if they will not work at all.
What's the time span from the time that there is a harvest of either of these models until it gets to the new person?
Right, so good question. If there's a fresh harvest where it's done literally within a day, and sometimes, otherwise it can be frozen, it can be a longer time period to freeze. We'll see a very important outcome with that. But the most important distinction between blood donation and bone marrow donation is the following. In blood donation, as we said, there are millions of people that have the same blood type. In bone marrow donation, it is quite possible that if you match in a bone marrow donation, you will literally be the only person in the entire world who is a match for this individual. Literally. And there's some people who don't find matches at all. But if you find a match, it could literally be the only person in the entire world. So the question begs itself, are you mechuyev to test? And if you're found to be a match, are you mechuyev to donate? Now, we will discuss that presently, but before I forget to mention, whether you're mechuyev to do it or not, I think every single Jew in the entire world should be on the bone marrow donor list. There is literally no other way, or few other ways in the entire world, that you can potentially save the life of another human being with so little effort. It is the kind of opportunity that none of us should pass up. And I think we should have bone marrow donation parties. I don't know what the age, I think it's 17 where you start to become able to donate. So I think it should be institutionalized that part of your 17-year-old birthday party, you should come with a little cheek swab, and you should all send cheek swabs and be on the bone marrow list. It's Kabbalah otherwise, yes?
Is it true that not all those five samples
have been processed? I don't know. I can't comment on that. Okay. Did you have a question in the back, or just still stretching? Okay. So are you mechuyev to do it? So here is an article by Leo Schlesinger, who writes the following, and he says, I'll just synopsize, he basically says that you should be mechuyev to do it, that it is a simple thing to do, it's not a major risk to you, and by the way, we have to assess the risk. What's the risk of bone marrow donation? So the risk is clearly higher than blood donation, but it's not immensely higher. People don't die during bone marrow donation. Now, if you're boring into the bone, you might need anesthesia, which is a risk. You could have an infection, which is a risk. But these things, I wouldn't say they're negligible, but they're much less than, say, a real operation. So he argues that indeed you should, and that you might indeed be mechuyev to donate. Now, let me share with you the following case, tragic case which happened in Eretz Yisrael, which highlights our question about whether you're mechuyev or not. Now, Rabbi Orlean's question is very much on point. So here was the case. There was a woman who agreed to donate to a particular individual. And the way donation works when you're doing a fresh harvest is the following. We said the bone marrow donation replaces the bone marrow of the recipient. So that needs to be eradicated or irradiated and destroyed. So that's what they did for this recipient. They destroyed that person's bone marrow and awaiting the harvest from the recipient. From the donor. Lo and behold, the donor decides at this stage that she doesn't want to donate anymore. Now, what happens to an individual who has no bone marrow? Anybody?
They die.
They die. You cannot survive without a bone marrow. Your bone marrow is your immune system. You cannot survive without it. And they told her, and this was an Eretz Yisrael, and this is a firm woman. And the Gedolim came to her doorstep and tried to prevail upon her and say, you know, you realize that if you don't go through with this donation, this person might actually die. And as it turned out, she maintained her refusal, and the patient died. Horrible tragedy. Question is, from a halachic perspective, can you coerce that individual to do it or not? So, if this was the United States, can you coerce somebody to serve as a bone marrow donor?
No.
So we all know the American law. What does halacha say? So here, it's going to depend. Very briefly, as a major machlokas, they actually asked Moshe Sternbach in the journal Asya to comment on this, and he said you could not, at the end of the day, coerce this woman to do it. Rabbi Bleich, on the other hand, is definitely an advocate of potential coercion. Rabbi Willig also is an advocate of potential coercion in these cases, because the potential life-saving is great. Now, you will ask me about the Jew-non-Jew question. So here, the Jew-non-Jew question has an interesting twist, because it's all anonymous, too. You're not able to donate to a specific, you really donate to the pool. You don't know who your bone marrow is going to, even when you're doing the harvest. But there's a fair chance that genetically, if you are a match to somebody, the odds are that you're probably much, much higher than it's going to be a fellow Jew that you're donating to. I'm not saying that should be the only reason you do it. The tremendous Kiddush Hashem involved in donating to anybody is obviously there. This is for another time, but there's a famous book and a movie called My Sister's Keeper, which highlights the issue of a katan, about whether you can allow a katan to serve as a donor for both blood and bone marrow and even kidney. But maybe we'll save that for another time. So in conclusion of our case study one, should this person go and sign up for the bone marrow drive? So the answer, I think we would say, is an absolute yes. If he signs up, he's found to be a match, he's mechuyev to donate. According to some of the poskim here in this wonderful yeshiva, the answer may indeed be yes. It may indeed be mechuyev to donate. What about kidney donation? It's our next case. So kidney donation, yes.
Yes, absolutely. Is there a difference with regards to the case in Israel that the woman would have pulled out before she had destroyed the bone marrow?
Right, so good. So a lot of people sign up to be donors and then they just renege. That happens a lot, and there have been many cases like that. So that's a very different case. I mean, the person still might end up dying, by the way.
Right.
If this person is the only the only donor and there's no other match, the person still might end up dying, but I think there's first of all, less pressing of an issue, because literally the person's going to die in days as opposed to months or years. And in terms of her chiyuv for as rotzeach, because she's directly responsible for that eradication of that bone marrow, which immediately caused the death. It's still a grumma, obviously. She's not doing the mice and be dying. It'd be an interesting discussion. Yes.
If this is really this one person to give would that imply that they have a halal Shabbos for it? They call you up and tell you you're the only match.
Absolutely. I mean, rarely does it have to be full of Shabbos, because it's usually not minutes or hours in these cases. It's days to weeks. But if it came to that, absolutely. Absolutely would be. If they said the harvest has to be done today and this person's mamish needs it, that's there's no greater case of pikuach nefesh for full Shabbos than that. I mean, but like I said, rarely, if ever, is bone marrow donation. It's usually an elective procedure and you have time to do it. Kidney donation. How is kidney donation different? So, very important. We talked about difference of medical donors. So, blood regenerates in the body when you give it, in terms of the risk that you're taking. Bone marrow regenerates in the body. So, if you harvest bone marrow from someone, a couple months later, the bone marrow is back to the way it was before. When you're giving a kidney, there's a couple fundamental differences. Your kidney does not regenerate. Now, you could argue that Kosh Baruch Hu gave us two kidneys because he wanted us to donate one of them. But your kidneys do not regenerate. So when you take that kidney, that's it. So if someone gives you a kidney punch in the other kidney, now you're stuck. The other issue is, how is it going to impact your future life? Are you going to go into kidney failure because you have only one kidney? Is there a higher likelihood of you developing high blood pressure as a result of only one kidney? So these are things which have been studied by the medical community. And the answer is maybe a small percentage increase, but not significantly enough to make any difference. But historically, when they first started kidney donation, it's Tzitzel Eliezer Paskind, and as also Diane Weiss in the Minchas Yitzchak said, removing a kidney from one of the internal organs in the elderly, even though the person donor is healthy, so he is writing in the 60s. This psak is in the 60s. Now this is essential when you're doing any medical halachic research and you are looking up a tshuva on any topic. You must know when that tshuva was written and what the scientific knowledge of that tshuva was when that tshuva was written if you're going to paskin based on that tshuva. So if you open up this tshuva and say, oh, the Tzitzel Eliezer says, us to donate kidneys, so that would be an egregious misapplication of halacha, because even he himself says, if the physicians later on tell me that it's not so risky, then I'll say it's okay. So just to put this into the categories of the Radbaz, so blood and bone marrow clearly fall into the very low-risk categories as far as the Radbaz is concerned, and you'd be mutter, if not mechuyev, to do it. Kidney donation clearly falls into the middle category. It's not a small procedure, it's a surgical procedure, removing a kidney from the body, but it is done with surgical precision and technique and asepsis and antibiotics in a medical hospital. So it's not high risk. Having said that, patients die from kidney donations. And don't fool yourself to think that it's a minor thing. It is not. So let me share with you a story from my hospital. I work at Montefiore Medical Center, one of the major kidney transplant centers in the Northeast. We do thousands of kidney transplants. About a year and a half ago, there was a patient who came in to donate a kidney for her family member, a healthy woman, and as we parenthetically mentioned before, in a hypothetical case, the real-life case here, they were harvesting the kidney from this woman, and they accidentally hit the aorta. And this woman started to bleed out. And they needed a cardiothoracic surgeon to help repair the aorta, and they were able to get someone to rush in, but it was too late. And the woman died on the table. And to add insult to injury, it happened to be National Organ Donor Day, and there was literally a parade of people celebrating organ donation right outside the doors of the hospital. And a few floors up, someone actually died in the course of the donation. As a result of this donation, Montefiore's program was shut down. It is now back up and running again in full force. But it's a surgery. And any time you take a sharp instrument into the abdomen, I don't care what you're doing, it's a potentially life-ending possibility. So it is a risk. What percentage of people who donate kidneys have this complication? 0.01. But it's not zero. So people do die. So today, and these are just some of the literature sharing with you, and Psak of Ravad Yosef. But the bottom line is, today in 2014, there is not a single posik who says it's usur to donate kidneys. Every posik says it's mutter. Some come close to saying you're mechuyev, although no one can really force you to do it because there is a risk involved. There are organizations now, every week in the Jewish press, in the Jewish week, you'll see articles like this asking for people to donate kidneys. This just happens to be someone who's thanking someone for donating, and this is Stuart de Greenstein, who's a firm transplant surgeon at Montefiore. He and I actually learned Chavrusa together, the halachic issues in transplant. There's a wonderful organization called Renewal. Anybody here hear of the organization called Renewal? Very few of you. Renewal is an organization which works on kidney. They're a shadchanis organization, basically, but a different type of shadchanis. They're mishadech people who, it's an unbelievable thing. People who want to donate a kidney and don't even care who they're donating to. They just feel that they want to donate a kidney, als chesed. And they're mishadech these people with people here, and sometimes these people are from Eretz Yisrael, sometimes the recipients are from Eretz Yisrael, sometimes the donors are from Eretz Yisrael. And I am on their email list, and I get an email every time a donation is being performed from their services, and I'm getting emails very frequently. Sometimes I'll get an email that two or three transplants will be done the same day. They've done dozens and dozens, if not hundreds, of transplants already. Unbelievable organization. And it has the imprimatur of many of the posthum, and it's just to share with you this kasha, I won't tell you the teretz, see if you guys can figure it out. But this is a real-life case. There was a chaver Knesset who needed a kidney, and he had five sons, and his doctor said he needed a living transplant, and a living transplant would be better for him. So he came home from his doctor, and one of his sons was at home. And he said, "Dad, where you been?" So he said, "Well, I was at the doctor," and he said, I need a kidney transplant." So that son immediately went out to Shari Tzedek, or actually Hadassah Hospital, to get himself tested to see if he was a match. When he comes home, his other brothers are back in the house, and said, "Chaim, where you been?" He said, "Oh, I just wanted to get tested because I'm going to be a kidney donor for Abba." So he said, "What do you mean you're going to be a kidney donor for Abba? What about the rest of us? We want to be a kidney donor to Abba." And the Bechor says, "I'm a Bechor, and I only have chiyuvim. I have a right to be a donor over you." So they asked Ashila, and so this I just surreptitiously found this safer many years ago, and it was like just somebody who dropped off a few copies in Eichler's. But so the entire safer is this Shaila. I happen to know who it's about because it turns out it's a shtickle relative of mine. I did not know who wrote the psalm. It went to a Rav. It turns out it was Rav Yashiv they went to. This is all anonymous and safer. In any case, he passed in the Shaila. Extra credit to Rabbi Orly, and extra credit for anybody who can figure out the answer to that Shaila who gets to be the organ donor. But Lamaisa, you know, going back to our question, is it permitted to donate the first kidneys? The answer is absolutely permitted to donate the first kidney. Is it mutter to donate the second kidney? So the second kidney, briefly, is a much more complex situation because somebody donating their second kidney would have to go on dialysis. And dialysis, while if you need it, is a tremendous life-saving thing, and Mamish people would die if they didn't have an artificial kidney, which is called dialysis. But there's a high risk of dialysis. There's a high risk of infection, high risk of heart attacks, high risk of strokes, and a high risk of death. So it probably would be in the highest category for Radbaz. Probably would be usur for him to donate. And in fact, the medical community did not accept his request, and no surgeon harvested that second kidney. This will save for another time. These are non-vital organ transplants. Risk and contagion. Also, shifting to our third case for the final few minutes. This is a picture of a physician in the Middle Ages treating patients with plague. Right? What's he wearing in his hands? Okay, now what's he wearing on his face? What does he look like?
A duck or something.
Looks like a duck, right? So what is the purpose of the mask? Anybody? This is not like the bird's head Haggadah. You guys ever see the bird's head Haggadah or all the figures? You know, this. What do you say?
They have a
pop-up version of the bird's head Haggadah? Well, that's great. That's great. So next they'll have a holographic version, you know, just to... So what's the purpose of this? So the purpose of this beak is not so he looks like a bird or a duck. The purpose of this beak is, you know, excuse me, being graphic for a few moments, but if you were a physician in the plague in the Middle Ages, death was ever present, and rotting flesh was ever present. And if you walked into a house where the plague was there, the smell could be so profoundly disturbing that you would literally faint. So they devised these masks have some sweet-smelling substance, you know, cinnamon and honey and spices, basically, and to cover the face so you wouldn't get the fumes, so you'd be able to do your job. Otherwise, you simply wouldn't even be able to do your job. This is me, yesterday, doing my Ebola training. And this is the same concept, just a few hundred years later. So we are mandated to do training for Ebola. This looks, there are many different, you know, if you see the hazmat, we don't have the real hazmat stuff. The real hazmat stuff is like one bodysuit. Now I'm lobbying to get us those bodysuits. But we are an Ebola receiving center. We have to train to be able to treat these patients. And doing that is, I will not lie to you, it's pretty frightening prospect to be able to, to think that I might have to treat somebody with a disease, which is a fatal disease and doesn't really have a clear cure. So it's not something that I take lightly. But let's just go through for the last few minutes. We'll discuss the history of contagion in rabbinic sources and move up into to finish our last case study. So contagion is actually discussed interestingly in the Rishonim in explaining a couple different episodes in Tanakh. And we'll just mention this briefly. If those interested, as always, I'm happy to share more. But in when Ashes Lot and Lot and their whole family were leaving Sodom, it's the pasuk says, "Al tabeit acharecha v'al tamod b'chol akikor." It says, "Don't stop, don't turn around, don't look." So the Ramban says, and by the way, Ramban, not only was the Rambam a physician, the Ramban was also a physician. We know from the Rashba, his Talmud, that the Ramban was a physician. He quotes his Talmud, he quotes his Rebbe practicing medicine in a few different ways. He says, "Ki haros ba'avir ha-dever." He gives you an example, the Ramban. What is dever, by the way? Dever is plague, right? And the dever, the fifth of the Makos, is dever. That is the word which is used in plague. Just a brief one-second parenthesis. Shechin, there's some who consider Shechin, and there's an entire linguistic etymological debate about what Shechin is, and some think the Shechin of the Torah is anthrax, which is another infectious disease, which is also a disease of bioterror. People were sent powder anthrax, you remember those from just a few years back. So they actually just recently decided at some convention of medical etymology to call anthrax shechin in modern linguistic Hebrew. So if you see someone in Israel and they're talking about anthrax, they'll be using the word shechin. So he says, when there's dever in the air, u'chol ha'chalim ha'nidbakim, all the illnesses which are nidbakim. What does a chalim chalim ha'nidbakim mean? Right. Contagious diseases, infectious diseases, diseases that can adhere one to another. So this notion of disease spread and disease contagion goes back to the Middle Ages, the Ramban. And the same thing here in the Ramban's student, Rabbeinu Bechaye, writes in by Korach, it says, "He badlu mitocho ido hazos v'chalosom karoga." So Kosh Baruch Hu says to Moshe and Aaron, says, get away from these guys, I'm going to destroy them. So the obvious question is, well, Kosh Baruch Hu can't selectively destroy people, what, they've got to move out of the way. So Rabbeinu Bechaye says, well, when he unleashes the contagious disease, will spread to who's ever there. So you got to get out of the way. So these are ideas of contagion. And plague, and black death, and bubonic plague, I mean, there's plague upon plague in every decade, in every century, in the pre-modern era, there were plagues, and it's vastly different than today. I mean, if you would have lived in the times of these Rishonim and early Acharonim, there were so many diseases, and there were no concept of what the disease cause was. There was no concept of a cure for these diseases, and thousands and hundreds of thousands and millions upon millions of people would die every year from these diseases across the modern civilized world, and they have to deal with the consequences of this. So the big question was: are you allowed to leave the city if there's a dever? If there's a plague, some form of plague. Now, dever generally is a generic term for plague. It could mean whatever. We don't need to talk about the specifics, and historians do, by the way. So the Maharil is very often quoted as saying, "Mikol ha'nimorad ein tov la'amod b'mokom sakana." If there's a risk, you don't stay in the same place, like al tamod b'chol akikar. And you leave. You're allowed to flee the city. I've seen gedolim that have fled the city. And the Rama writes also. The Rama writes in Shulchan Aruch, when they're talking about risky things, Od kosher sheish livroach min ha'ir kishadever ba'ir yesh latzeis min ha'ir betchila sadever. You should leave at the beginning of the plague, because otherwise it will be too late. Yes. Oh, what's the reason not to leave? So I guess it's really, and we'll talk actually the reason not to leave, if you have certain responsibilities. So if you're the rav of the shtat, if you're the physician, you know, can you leave? And those are discussed halachically, yes. Right, so they didn't necessarily think about those, and that just reminded me about a source which I should have brought to you, and I have to remember when we talked about Ebola. Remind me, the Zilberstein has a very specific shiloh about leaving one place and going to another and potential transfer. Bikur Cholim, right? There were discussions about Bikur Cholim. So this is the Bikur Cholim Society in Berlin in 1750, and they write specifically in their Bikur Cholim manual which diseases you don't have to be Bikur Cholim for because they're potentially fatal. So they write Kagon... Shulshul, like certain diarrheal illnesses, which is probably cholera. Ababuot, Shekorim Pakin, which is smallpox, which we'll get to in a moment. Mazalin, which is measles. You know, all these different diseases they're quoting. And this is also halachic shaila. Chola b'choli hamizdabek, someone has a contagious illness. Imutur l'shamsho, lai osur mishum u'shmartim odu nafsho seifim. And it's like Ma'abed Atzmo L'das. Are you committing suicide by going to be Mishamish, someone who has a contagious illness? The financial consequences. So if you're a teacher, you're a Malamed, and either your student or you leave for the plague and then come back, are you Mechuyev to pay out the whole year's salary or just partial salary? This is very much related to contemporary discussions. Contagion of the body. So the poskim talk about bodies were often buried in massive graves to prevent the spread of contagion, because even then they understood that the contagion was spread from the body. That's one of the things about Ebola, by the way, that Ebola, many diseases, once you die, the contagion ends. In Ebola, the contagion actually is extremely high in the body. So what they do with people who die of Ebola is they incinerate the body, they cremate the body. And many, part of the reason that it's spread wildly in West Africa is because some people will lie and say that their family members don't have the symptoms of Ebola when they know they did, and they'll do a ritual funeral, and everyone will come to the funeral and kiss the body and touch the body, and it can transmit the disease to another, you know, 40, 50, 200 people. So this is a shiloh, and the Chassam Sofer wasn't talking about cremation, he was talking about just provisional burial. But it's a halacha ma'aser shaila. If someone dies of this, you know, cremation is usher, according to the poskim. Another fascinating history of cremation. But the very first time we were able to treat a disease, an infectious disease, was this particular disease. So another extra credit, if anyone can tell me what this is. Anybody? Smallpox. Yeah, this is smallpox. I've never seen a case, and I know none of you have ever seen a case, because the last time there was a case, you guys weren't alive. So this is a disease which, for reasons which we're talking about now, is not even around anymore. So smallpox is responsible for killing millions of people. Millions. And it affected the Jewish community the same as the other community. So when they finally got a treatment for it, it was a tremendous advance in the world of medicine. And what was that treatment? It was a very unique treatment never before seen in the history of mankind. What they would do is, this is a sick child who had smallpox. They'd make a little incision in the pox, take out some of the fluid, and in a different painting, the same concept, this is the healthy child, they would inject that fluid into a healthy child in the hopes that this person would get a mild form of the disease and not die. And it worked. Most of the time. Some of the time, the person who received the inoculation, as it was called, didn't do so well. So this could happen if you receive an inoculation. And worse, this could happen. In memory of Peleg, son of Thomas and Mary Conklin, who died of smallpox by inoculation. January 1788, age 17 years old. This tombstone sits not far from my house, Huntington, Long Island. So you would give someone an inoculation. So this is the first time in history that people would give someone who was healthy a bit of disease in the hopes that it would prevent them from developing a more severe form of the disease. So the Poskim talked about this. This is an entire sefer called Alei Trufa, written in the 1700s by someone who lost two children to smallpox, heard about this new inoculation, and then begged the Poskim of his generation to allow this form of treatment, even though there were risks involved. Famously, the person, one of the people who responded was Tiferes Yisrael, writing about this case. Zeh nirli heter la'asos inoculation shel pakin. After his lengthy halachic analysis, he says it's mutter to do inoculation. Why? Because even though there is a risk with the inoculation, and indeed some percentage of people will die as a result of the inoculation, if you don't do the inoculation, you're much more likely to die. And if there's an epidemic. So this really started the whole concept of vaccination. We're not going to discuss the historical addendum, but it ultimately led to vaccination. And vaccination today is responsible for saving tens, if not hundreds of millions of lives. We're vaccinated for many, many different diseases, many different conditions. So Baruch Hashem, we don't live in the same kind of age as in the past. But there are many other illnesses. One of those, for example, is AIDS. You know, so when I started practicing and I was training as a resident, AIDS came on the scene. I remember I was actually stuck with a needle as a resident of someone who had AIDS at that time. And the panic was panic-stricken for weeks, Baruch Hashem, nothing came of it. The postgame, we're not talking now about AIDS, but the postgame had lengthy discussions about AIDS. One of the areas where risk is assessed is whether you're allowed to do mitzitza bepeh on an infant if there's a suspicion for AIDS. And here, you know, clearly you would not be allowed to do that kind of thing. But there are other conditions and other diseases, not just Ebola, which we have today, which we don't even focus so much on in the media, and you guys may not even be aware of. So, and I mentioned the ones that have this, prevalence in the Jewish community specifically. Mumps. There was a mumps outbreak in the Jewish community 2012. You guys know about that? Don't know about that? No? Some of you do, some of you don't. Measles. September 2013. There was a measles outbreak in the Brooklyn Jewish community. Swine flu actually wasn't so prevalent in the Jewish community, but I'm just going to share this with you because it's just a hysterical comment. Swine flu comes from pigs, swine. So they asked in Eretz Yisrael, you know, the Chachamim in Eretz Yisrael asked, are you still allowed, obviously not from us, but are you still allowed to eat pig if there's swine flu around? So the health organization in Israel said, Hey, Kaim Israel Achilas Boser Chazir. So their answer was, Eim Chashash Me Achilas Boser Chazir Shebushal Kahalacha. So as long as you cook it according to halacha, you're good. Of course, kalacha means, you know, thoroughly, completely. Doesn't mean halacha like contemporary halacha. Polio. Polio is now making a resurgence. I send my son's in Eretz Yisrael, second year Shalomim now, and I got an email from from my pediatrician at home that he should be vaccinated for polio, because polio is now back on the rise. So why is Ebola different? Why are we so freaked out about Ebola, and we're not so crazed about these others? So the answer is that Ebola is an extremely fatal disease, and we don't really have we do not have a vaccine for Ebola to prevent us from developing it, and we don't really have a known, clearly proven cure for it either. We have experimental cures which are working, but not been definitively proven. So that's why people are so scared. And the shilas that this is an ethical shila, which is a very much a halachic shila too, and very much relates to my practice. If you have some, we talked about the body is a tremendous reservoir for Ebola, and these patients are bleeding significantly. That's part of the disease. So let's say I have a patient that comes in with Ebola, it's in cardiac arrest. Am I going to perform CPR on this patient? So if I perform CPR on this patient, I am subjecting myself to tremendous risk of disease. And the ethics community, by the way, came out with a statement that you are not obligated to do it because the benefit to the patient is almost zero, because at that stage they're probably not going to recover, and the risk to the patient, to the physician, and to others is much higher. Let me just finish, and I'm happy to take questions. This is the physician that just got out of Bellevue. He's actually an ER physician who went to Africa with the Physicians Without Borders and contracted Ebola. Baruch Hashem, he was cured. And there's the Shilas, by the way, that the postgame didn't talk about Ebola, but it's just as related to Ebola. This is Nishmas Kochai, Zer Chaim Pelagi, writes, if a physician who's treating contagious patients, like let's say this guy's a from Jew, and he wants to come to Shul, to Davin, with a minion, is the Shul allowed to say, you know, stay outside, don't expose us to the potential risk of these kinds of conditions? This Shiloh was asked Rav Moshe, and it's very relevant. We talked about what they do. What do you think they do with the clothes of anybody who's exposed to somebody with Ebola?
They burn them.
What do you think when this guy changes clothes, or they come out of the laundry, they don't put them in the laundry, send them to your local laundry. They burn them. So someone asked Rav Moshe Shiloh, which is very relevant to this, if you have a patient who's got a contagious disease, and you bring him tefillin to daven, and you know that after he's finished with these tefillin, they're going to incinerate the tefillin, are you allowed to bring in the tefillin or not? So he actually passed him no. Because of the issue of Mechikas Hashem, and he said you're not allowed to. So just in conclusion, I'll just share with you is one obligated to treat these patients? So there is a healthcare worker obligated to treat these patients. So Tzitz Eliezer has a number of different of discussions, and he says maybe a healthcare worker might have an obligation to accept a higher risk, maybe because Rapo Yerapé allows them to do that, maybe because they're being paid to do it that allows them to do it, and a whole host of other things. But clearly this is the most important things, that if someone is entering into a potentially risky situation, it would be responsible not only for the patient should have refuah, but the physician shouldn't have any exposure, any negative exposure as a result. And just to conclude with the following, we talked about risk and organ donation in particular. It is true there is risk in these things, however, the Aruch HaShulchan, in essence, says that don't be so machmir in terms of risk when you can potentially help somebody else. Because, in essence, what goes around comes around. So if you are not making the effort to be matzil someone, to put yourself in a little bit of risk to save somebody else, the time may indeed come where you need someone's assistance, and they may withhold that based on the same cheshbon. So here you have these people at a meeting. Sort of reflects this idea. It says we've considered every potential risk except the risks of avoiding all risks. So in conclusion, we've had an opportunity to discuss some of the issues related to blood donation and bone marrow donation, and the issue of infectious and contagious diseases and risk. Of course, there's much, much more we could talk about, and I apologize we didn't get to everything, but I'm happy to answer whatever questions you have and to continue the discussion at another time. Yes.
Yeah. Okay, let's ask you a question at the lower end of the spectrum.